Welcome. I'm Sarah White, a retired director of pharmacy who has a continued interest in leadership. The purpose of this conversation with a successful leader is to hear in their own words the experiences they've had, the lessons they've learned, so that we can glean those tips. I'd like to welcome Paul Pierpaoli. By way of introduction, let me briefly describe Paul's career. He received his pharmacy degree in 1960 from the University of Rhode Island, his master's in residency at the University of Michigan. He has held leadership positions at NIH, University of Connecticut Health Center, Medical College of Virginia Hospitals, and Rush Presbyterian St. Luke's Medical Center. Before retiring, he was Senior Vice President, Pharmacy Practice for Medication Management with McKesson. Paul, tell us the story of how you chose pharmacy and then a master's residency.
Certainly. It really wasn't magic in a sense, but the odyssey started, so to speak, when I was in high school. There was no individual or connection with my pharmacy, with my family to pharmacy. But I was just taken by the curriculum that the School of Pharmacy offered. It produced a nice blend of biological sciences as well as physical sciences. And I was pretty introspective at the time and said, look, I'm not strong in chemistry, but I do like chemistry, but I don't want to be a chemist. But I did enjoy the biology connection. So I was attracted primarily by the subject matter of the curriculum, and it proved to be something that I took to very quickly. So that was my start. There were no lightning bolts. There were no individuals that were members of my family or friends, et cetera, that were in pharmacy at all.
So how did the residency master's program come about?
Well, that happened while I was an undergraduate student at the University of Rhode Island. I happened to have had a professor who was an analytical chemist by the name of Joseph Sinsheimer, who has since passed away. But Dr. Sinsheimer happened to be on the faculty at the University of Rhode Island at the time, and he was a graduate of the University of Michigan and received his three degrees, including his PhD degree at Michigan. And he kind of sensed that I had an interest in hospital pharmacy and was able to see that perhaps that's where I wanted to spend my life. He went to great lengths to inform me that I was to go to the University of Michigan to graduate school, which at the time had one of the strongest, if not the strongest, graduate program and residency program in hospital pharmacy with Dr. Don Franke, who was director of the program at that time. So I ended up in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and became a lifelong Wolverine, if you will. But it made a big difference in my career as well, because the residency was a defining moment in my career, as was the graduate program and the connection to Dr. Franke and his wife, Gloria Niemeyer Franke, who were tremendous influences on my life and my whole view of pharmacy practice and how I should look at my career and that kind of thing.
Why don't you expand a little bit on the legacy that Don and Gloria Franke left? Because they're really icons in health system pharmacy.
Stewardship was probably the biggest part of the legacy. In addition to stewardship, Franke was always very explicit about the fact that pharmacy had, up until that time, put its interests above its purpose. And he really admonished us as residents and graduate students to put your purpose before your interests. Do the right things for pharmacy. And much of that had to do with the legacy of stewardship, nurturing the profession, growing the literature, the obligation that you had to contribute to the literature by writing, active presentation, by active involvement in professional organizations, those kinds of things. So I would say that perhaps professional stewardship was the biggest part of their legacy, at least as I remember it.
You've been passionate throughout your career with residency training. Talk a little bit about how you related and helped your residents.
Well, I was passionate. Let me back up for a moment and say, what were the reasons I was passionate about things? I became passionate largely because at that time, this was in the late 50s and early 60s, hospital pharmacists just didn't have the measure of respect or status that at least in my mind, I thought they should have. They did not have that. And this really fired my passion to change things, to build on it, to improve it. And I have tried to do that with my residents over the years as well, as I've mentored them. And I've at this point mentored a number, well over 100 residents, and that's been a very significant part of my own, perhaps, tiny contribution in terms of somewhat of a legacy, if you want to call it that, if you want to dignify it by calling that.
One of your past residents told me that when they were with you, there was a little desk right outside of your office that they worked at, and you included them in everything that you did. You want to expand on that a little bit?
Yeah. I've always maintained that it has to be a very inclusive relationship, that when residents are doing a rotation with you, they have to see the good, the bad, the ugly, and be with you as much as possible. Sometimes that's difficult to do because of circumstances in terms of reporting relationships to people in a hospital or in any organization. But I insisted that they be involved in everything, the good, perhaps maybe too much of the ugly, but there's also something to learn from the ugly as well. But any good mentor has to realize that they have to share as much as they possibly can. And that includes sometimes being able to bare your soul and say, look, I don't know the answer to this question, but let's try to find an answer together, and together we can find that answer. And that in itself becomes a learning experience. So that's perhaps, in a nutshell, what I have tried to focus on in terms of involving my residents. Another factor is I've always been a student of the school of taking people out of their comfort zone and putting them into new responsibilities where they run the risk of failure, perhaps, in a controlled way, but at the same time they develop confidence and self-knowledge, which is a very important important component of developing leadership skills.
So when you finished your program, how did you find your first leadership position?
My first leadership position was at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda. I was fortunate to have gone into the public health service as a result of the fact that Dr. Franke was a good friend of the person who was chief of pharmacy services at NIH, a man named Milton Scolott, who ultimately became president of ASHP. That was my very first position after my residency program, and going to a place like NIH was just like being in a candy shop, in a sense that at that time, those were the real halcyon days of healthcare. Money was available to do some very innovative things, and we tried to do that at NIH. We were able to translate evolving hospital pharmacy concepts into reality. For instance, intravenous admixture services. We were the first hospital to have a comprehensive intravenous admixture service, and that was one of my first projects and assignments, was to establish a pilot intravenous admixture service, and we did that well before the days of laminar flow hoods and all the other technology that's now available. So it was a wonderful experience, and the same applied on the clinical side of things, especially in a research-intensive environment like NIH, where you had an opportunity to deal with some of the best minds in medicine and in pharmacy, for that matter.
One of the things you've done throughout your career is published. Why did you spend extra effort that it takes to write and to publish in our literature?
Well, much of that came from Frankie's legacy. Part of his legacy to us as residents was the ability to communicate effectively, both in writing and in terms of our verbal skills. So he spent a lot of time assigning us abstracts to write, which ultimately were published in International Pharmaceutical Abstracts or the American Journal of Hospital Pharmacy at the time. And he was an editor first and foremost, because he was the founding editor of AJHP. And he spent a lot of time critiquing what you wrote and making it very clear that when you write something, the written word lasts forever. It's quite different than the spoken word. And it was also a way to contribute to the literature, part of the legacy of nurturing the profession and trying to pursue our purpose over our interests, which had been a problem in pharmacy in the 40s and 50s, at least as I recall as a student and as a resident.
You've been in several different academic health centers. Before we get to the specifics, talk a little bit about your philosophy of the practice model in an academic center where there's an associated school of pharmacy.
Well, first and foremost, by definition, any academic health science center has respective health schools that are embedded in the structure of an organization. Part of the philosophy in those environments, as I see it, is to make service, education, and research a continuum. You can't wall them off. They're all related to each other. Now, medicine has done that very effectively with schools of medicine, so have dental schools, etc. Schools of pharmacy, however, have had struggles in this regard. Very often, I don't know if it's very often, but I would say all too often, we have situations where schools of pharmacy do not have a service mission in that hospital that's legitimately tied to the Department of Pharmacy, where pharmacy education and service are one and the same. They're a continuum. We have to remember that the concept of an academic health science center and medical school education being a continuum with service goes back to Sir William Osler, over a century ago at Johns Hopkins, who made it very clear that if medicine were going to grow and become a science, it had to do so on the back of service, that you provide outstanding service to patients, improving their health care, but in the process you're teaching young physicians. And the same ought to be true of pharmacy. But we're having a problem, I think, struggling with that in many academic health science centers that have schools of pharmacy within them.
Throughout your career, not only have you had faculty appointments in the schools of pharmacy, but you've made sure you had a faculty appointment in the medical school. Why was that important, and what value did that bring you?
Well, that started when I was at the University of Connecticut. I was very fortunate to have been there. It was a brand new medical school and a brand new health science center at the time. And I was welcomed as a member of the faculty. In fact, my first faculty appointment at Connecticut was in the School of Medicine in the Department of Community Medicine, not the School of Pharmacy. Later, the relationship with the School of Pharmacy developed. But it became obvious to me that if you look at the governance of any academic health science center, or any hospital for that matter, physicians are key stakeholders. And you have to have an appropriate collegial, I'm talking about a true collegial kind of relationship with those physicians. So I think the notion of having a director of pharmacy be a member of the School of Pharmacy faculty and be involved at a policy-making level is very critical to the success of pharmacy ultimately and improving drug therapy in an overall sense.
You've also worked at both a state-funded and a private-funded academic center. Talk a little bit about what differences, if any, you saw in how those were funded.
I would say, in fact, I sought out the opportunity to go to Rush Presbyterian because prior to going there, Connecticut and the Medical College of Virginia were both state-supported academic medical centers. I selected Rush because it was a private practice, not-for-profit, but sort of traditional fee-for-service medicine environment, not unlike the one you were at Stanford in California. And I found that it was quite a different environment. I had a sense that it was a different environment, but the big differences were decision-making, number one, was brought down to the lowest possible level to the people who are responsible for results. And more importantly, there was a constant quest to make those decisions as quickly as possible. They're not as highly bureaucratized as state-supported institutions are, especially for management support issues like personnel and purchasing and those kinds of issues that we as directors have to deal with at times. So those were the prime differences: decentralization of decision making, and the other component, which is timeliness of making decisions, and the non-bureaucratization of decision making.
At the University of Connecticut, you were able to start from scratch with a brand new hospital and design the pharmacy services. Share with us your experience in doing that.
That was a wonderful experience. I went there in 1968 when the school was essentially just starting. There was just a big hole in the ground, and we all just had a vision that this was going to be a new and novel place for a medical school and a dental school and a hospital. And it subsequently has become quite an institution. It was wonderful because I had a blank piece of paper. I was told to go ahead and develop a state-of-the-art pharmacy service for that period of time. That involved, of course, unit dose, IV admixtures. I was able to apply the knowledge and information and experience that I had from NIH and other of our colleagues around the country. So we really started some innovative things in clinical pharmacy services, drug information services, and in the drug distribution side of things. It was very exciting, and the notion that there were no boundaries, you could do whatever you wanted to do, provided you could justify them and describe them in a way that everyone understood, and more importantly, that it helped patients.
Were there lessons that you learned through that have helped you the rest of your career?
Yes. Sometimes in my quest to be a little too aggressive, I burned some bridges behind me. I learned that one has to be a little selective about the battles that you choose to fight. You can lose the war over some mm-hmm. important battles, but primarily control and self-discipline, and not making a major issue out of something that's not really that important in the grand scheme of things. It's important to understand context, where you are in the bigger picture, and do not become sidetracked or brought in a different direction by your own blinded passion, if you will, if you believe in something that much. Now, sometimes you do have to follow your heart and your passion, but as a regular component in your diet, it's not good for your health or for your mental health as well.
You went to MCV following Connecticut and were to turn the department around. And MCV, if I remember correctly, was about a 1,000-bed hospital at that point in time.
Right.
And one of the things in the kind of late 70s that you were able to achieve is physician order entry in a computerized system where the physicians actually put their own orders in.
Right.
Talk a little bit about, because that was real early. I think you were one of the first in the country to have the physicians actually enter the orders, correct?
I would think, looking back at the time, I think we were probably the at least the largest hospital to have attempted to get direct physician order entry and to get virtually 100% compliance with physicians entering those orders. I was recruited just as the hospital was about to acquire a medical information system. And as a new director from Connecticut at the time, I was pressed to approve this new system from at least a pharmacy perspective. But there was enormous internal pressure from the nursing staff and even the medical staff, particularly the house staff, who made it very clear that they had no intention to be putting orders into a computer, that this is something that ward clerks should be doing. I found this to be repugnant and something that clearly was regressive in every sense of the term. So I said, look, I haven't moved my family here yet, and I can change my mind. I can, you know, pack my bag and go back to Connecticut, and I will do so unless we have some kind of an understanding that orders will be directly input by physicians, or there'll be adequate resources given to the Department of Pharmacy to put those orders in the form of pharmacy technicians and pharmacists at the time. So it turned out that I developed several allies on the medical staff, and again, this goes back to the importance of relationships with the medical staff in an academic medical center. The dean of the medical school backed me 100%, as did the chief of staff in the hospital, and they backed my stance and our stance and made a fiat, an executive fiat, that all orders would be put in by the house staff. And we went along doing that, and to my knowledge, they are still virtually 100% entered by the medical staff. So the issue wasn't technological per se, it was one of governance and control and some of the hefty politics that go on. And that's what happened. That's the story behind the story, at least as it relates to direct order entry at MCV.
So why did you choose to pick that battle to really stand tall?
Well, I saw anything else short of having direct order entry would have been, as I said, regressive. It's taking a step back to have a person that's not even a nurse or even a nurse putting an order into the system. And I saw that as a tremendous breach in the integrity and safety of the drug use process at the time, and said this cannot go. At least it wasn't going to happen during my watch. I might have been a little melodramatic about it, but nonetheless it worked out well.
So what were other challenges that you faced at MCV?
Well, one of the obvious challenges was we were also implementing unit dose and IV admixtures at the same time that we were implementing a medical information system, a mainframe medical information system. And you talk about the challenges, bringing our own pharmacy staff up to a given level of commitment emotionally and intellectually was a real challenge. There was a lot of work to be done, and we did it within a period of less than 2.5 to 3 years. We converted the entire, I think we had probably about 800 beds to convert to unit dose and IV admixtures, which included all the support elements, the packaging, and all those things, as well as implementing the information system. And one of the things we did was develop pharmacy implementation teams, small groups of people consisting of pharmacists and pharmacy technicians who would go up into patient care areas as we were going online and literally sitting at terminals and being in the nursing care area for 24 hours a day, helping frustrated house staff and attending staff putting orders into the system, so that finally everybody got on the system at the same time. That was very challenging.
A lot of change had to be taken care of. How did you help your pharmacy staff make those changes as well?
By constant communication. I think, you know, first of all, first and foremost, you don't hide in your office and develop edicts. You are constantly communicating your with your staff, letting them know what's about to happen, what are the possible downsides of things happening. And I think the more information you give people, the better off they are relative to understanding why they're doing something and why they're being asked to change. Because change, after all, is mobilizing others to want to do something about the status quo and pursue something that's better for everyone. And the more information you provide for people, the better off you are in that regard. And that's something that I always tried to do in terms of my management style.
You undoubtedly had a pharmacy leadership team that helped you. Talk a little bit about those individuals. I remember Carol Schroeder publishing some of this.
Yes. Well, one of my first needs was a person who was computer savvy, but who was very street smart relative to operations implementation. And it so turned out that Carol was that person. And I delegated that completely to her, because this was not, I made it very clear from the beginning that I am not an expert on computers, or at least I wasn't at the time. I'm still not, of course. I think the whole notion of delegating to people that you trust and have faith in, and do so in a manner that allows you to continually know what's going on at where you're negotiating with that person for specific outcomes after decisions are made as to what to do is very important. And sometimes it's very difficult for some people to let go. They want to micromanage. You can't. As organizations become more complicated and the span of services gets broader and broader, one has to delegate those responsibilities and let people go with it and deal with the consequences. Hopefully there aren't too many negative consequences, but understanding on the front end that there are always going to be some negative consequences and some fallout and collateral damage, as the military people say. But the notion of just, you know, imposing or inflicting things on people is something that's days that have now gone and left us, thank God.
So what were your challenges at Rush? After MCV, you moved on to Rush as, again, a director asked to sort of turn a department around.
Yes, Rush was a very different institution. It started ostensibly as a community hospital that ultimately resurrected an old medical school and combined the two and created Rush Presbyterian St. Luke's. Now it's called Rush Medical Center. But the challenge was that it was basically a large tertiary care community hospital in Chicago, well-respected, well-regarded, but candidly was a classic fee-for-service medicine kind of concept, where physicians had lucrative practices in three or four huge medical office buildings attached to the hospital, but very focused on the private practice of medicine. And suddenly I came in as director and was charged with the notion of bringing perhaps a little more collective decision-making to therapeutic issues through the P&T committee, through quality improvement initiatives, et cetera. And that was quite challenging, especially in an environment where physicians weren't used to sharing that kind of authority with people that weren't physicians. But we got through it. We got through it by developing, again, some strong relationships on the medical staff, largely through my faculty appointment and my involvement in the Department of Medicine, and other key departments like infectious diseases and other groups, the general surgeons, who became staunch allies of ours once we were able to prove our worth, so to speak.
What was the formulary like when you arrived at Rush?
There was no formulary. Formulary was ostensibly a four-letter expletive. You didn't use that word. There was a drug list, if you will, and it was made very clear to me by some of the incumbent leadership on the medical staff side, the private practice kind of people, that they had no intention of changing anything and that they didn't believe in any proscriptive approaches with formulary systems or any of these kinds of things. We, again, it took us 2 to 3 years to work through that, but we did, and it worked out to our benefit and to the patient's benefit and the medical center collectively.
So how did you utilize the Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee to do that?
Well, I would liken it to the fact that a Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee is essentially the conscience of a medical staff as it relates to looking at drug therapy in its collective sense, at least controlling which drugs were being used in the institution, how they were being used, how often should they be monitored, and also having a significant educational component. And we focused on the educational component initially. We didn't want to get into any authority battles with the medical staff. And we started by standardizing on some very non-controversial areas of drug therapy. We weren't going to deal with antibiotics or those kinds of things initially as we were trying to convert the mentality. The chairman of the P&T committee was very supportive, and our approach was to try to start with non-controversial areas. We started with potassium supplements and vitamins, and people were astounded when they came to a first meeting and saw that we had some 20 or 30 different multivitamin preparations, just as many potassium supplements, things that really weren't really major determinants of quality, but added to our costs and just complicated things. It also helped that I was on the faculty in the Department of Pharmacology and the Department of Medicine, and several of my key clinicians were, and they were beginning to get visibility teaching in the medical school and teaching with house staff, as we had a huge house staff of 350 or 400 house staff at Rush.
So talk a little bit about the clinical services that you found at Rush and how you evolved those.
The services we found were, at least that I inherited, had been put together by my predecessor, and they were quite effective in very selected areas. Nutrition support was one. At the time, that was very important. But the department had not developed a mission or a vision. So one of our first tasks was to develop a vision statement for what we wanted this pharmacy department to be and how it would affect outcomes in the institution, and also developing a mission statement with specific objectives, which were written into our budgetary applications every year. So our initial start was very slow, again, in non-controversial areas. The one where we perhaps made the most significant progress initially was in the infectious diseases area, where we started to develop some good relationships with the infectious disease people because they were part of the Department of Medicine. There were pressures to control drug costs, so we took advantage of that, worked with them very closely, and they even gave us a couple of positions that we could use and translate those into clinical specialist positions. We created clinical specialist positions in the department. We divided the level of expertise among technicians to three levels of technician expertise and created new job descriptions and did everything we possibly could to make major contributions to drug therapy in the institution. And I was satisfied that we had, given what we had inherited at the time.
So talk a little bit more about how you developed as a pharmacy department, your vision and your mission.
The vision statement and the mission statement and the things that flow out of that, the objectives, were not developed in isolation. I did not develop them, and I wasn't presumptuous enough to think that we could just inflict them on the staff. We developed the working groups of every level in the department, support staff, technicians, people working in other support elements of the department, pharmacists, clinicians, and developed these statements on the premise of what I would call the concept of creative dissatisfaction would be the way I'd like to state it. That is, we got people together and said, look, what is it that rubs us the wrong way here in terms of how we're doing things, how we're perceived by other departments, by other people in the institution? And how can we get over those? And it wasn't just a gripe session. I mean, that's one of the notions that I've always used in applying this concept of creative dissatisfaction. You just can't put a group of people together that just are going to bellyache and moan and groan about how bad things are, but they have to come up with alternative solutions to making things better. And that's what we tried to do with these groups. And we coalesced them, and it took us months to develop these, but we finally did, and we got everyone's shoulder to the wheel and got it going. And it was bought by every level in the department. The problem is that at times it takes longer to get these things rolled out than you think it does, and you have to keep working with staff to let them realize that this takes time. But the important thing is to continue to communicate with them on an ongoing basis regularly, which is terribly important.
After 16 years at Rush, you moved into the pharmaceutical industry. Talk a little bit about your considerations, the trade-offs, and et cetera.
Many people thought that perhaps, not that I'm such an important person, but many people thought that I had gone over to the dark side of the street, that there, you know, the shady side of the street where there's not a lot of light is not a place to be, and that's how many people at the time looked at anybody going over into industry. That's now a thing of the past. People don't think like that any longer. But I had done most of the things I wanted to do as a director of pharmacy in three distinct kind of academic health science centers, and thought it was time to see what life was like in another world where I could not have an influence just on one institution, mm-hmm. but on several institutions. And I was taken back by the work that was being done by a small subsidiary of McKesson at the time called McKesson Medication Management. I joined that organization and had no regrets whatsoever. We did some wonderful work with terms of consulting and pharmacy contract management and had the good fortune of turning around a number of departments, not just one department. Again, it's a much more highly leveraged way of influencing change, and that's what I saw in my move to going to industry, going to McKesson Medication Management. It was not industry per se, if we look at industry in the sense of drug innovation and those kinds of things. It's pharmacy management, if you will. But I enjoyed it very much.
So medication management actually managed the hospital pharmacies, is that correct?
Correct. We had different kinds of arrangements. In some cases, we provided a one-time consulting services. Other instances, we provided consulting services followed by a contract where we would run the pharmacy department. And there were various permutations of how the hospital chose to contract for that. So it was a very worthwhile experience. And just having to, it kind of renewed me in a sense. It allowed me to pick up a whole new way of thinking about the culture of an organization. I found it to be very stimulating and self-renewing, if you will. I have no regrets that I did that.
When you were still in practice as a director of pharmacy, you did projects with the pharmaceutical industry.
Right.
What are the considerations when one does that that need to be taken into account?
Well, I won't try to expound on any highfalutin ethical guidelines of behavior, but I think it's good old-fashioned common sense. First and foremost, you avoid an endorsement of products or programs. Flat-out endorsement is something that you have to be very careful about because your reputation is at stake. I think another issue is that you ought to use complete disclosure wherever possible. Disclose to the people that you're working with what your interests are and exactly what they are, as well as at your home base in your hospital. Another factor is that in this common sense approach is sorting out what's a testimonial for a product or a service or a program or technology from endorsement, if you will, unconditional endorsement. It's a very fine line, and one has to sometimes say no. If you don't, you can sully your reputation very quickly. So much of it is just good common sense.
In 1995, you received the very prestigious Harvey A.K. Whitney Lecture Award, the highest award in health system pharmacy. In your lecture title, you used the term iconoclast.
Right.
Would you talk a little bit about that and what your message was in your award talk, and is that still current?
Well, I was talking about iconoclasts in the figurative sense that they are individuals who tear down long believed in virtues or institutions that, and they buy into them unconditionally, thinking that's the only way to do things. And candidly, what concerned me was that in pharmacy practice, at the time I gave the presentation, and even now I would submit, there was a general understanding that pharmacy practice in America, in hospitals, was uniformly being practiced at the highest possible level. And I submit that that's not the case at all. I submitted that in the presentation and gave several examples and said the fact that what we need are individual pharmacists to apply their will, not just their skill, to changing how we practice pharmacy. And I don't think that's changed at all. We need to, even more so now, have people who believe and have the passion and emotional commitment to want to improve pharmacy practice in hospitals and not just accept that it's being practiced at this lofty level because we see it published in the journal or we see presentations being given by people who are giving testimonials, if you will, in some cases, which are fine, good examples. But it also calls into question the fact that we have a long way to go. The glass is not half empty, is not half full, it's half empty, if you will, and it should be addressed. And that's what my message was. At least I tried to present that at that time.
You've been very active in professional organization leadership, having served on the ASHP board and as a past president of ASHP.
Right.
Talk a little bit about the value to you and to the profession of being involved and using basically some of your personal time.
Well, I was a tremendous learning experience and enriching as well, because first and foremost, I got a deep appreciation for the various stakeholders in healthcare and pharmacy for that matter, and how complicated they are and the intricacies in dealing with those stakeholders. Mm-hmm. They're terribly important, and you don't have any idea unless you start to sit around the table at an ASHP board meeting or a planning session where you begin to appreciate all the stakeholders, the government, the private sector of the pharmaceutical industry, the pharmacy practice sector, the professional organizational sector. They all have very important ends that they're seeking. And to begin to get an appreciation for that and understand the intricacies of how those relate to each other is very important. Another benefit came from getting some very valuable experience in affecting the fiduciary responsibilities of being a member of the board of directors and the leadership of ASHP. ASHP is a large, complex organization, highly differentiated, and very complex. And it has to be managed as such, in a corporate sense, both from a business perspective and from a professional dynamics perspective. So that's something that was very, very beneficial to me. Another one, of course, is the development of your own personal skills, your planning skills, your organizational skills, your speaking skills, your writing skills, and last but not least, it's the opportunity to really look at your profession through a prism, if you will, where you can see who the innovators are, who are the early adopters, what are they doing, how are they affecting change in pharmacy practice, and how does that impact the profession in a much broader sense. So those were the major takeaways that I got from my active involvement in ASHP over the years. Very rewarding.
Explain what a fiduciary responsibility is.
Well, but you could look at it exclusively from a financial standpoint, or you could, in a more generic sense, a fiduciary responsibility is you're holding the assets of an entity in trust, if you will, and you're managing that trust to make sure that the right things are being done. And as Frankie guided us years ago, not to put our interests above our purpose, and making sure that we're always looking at that through the prism of reality to make sure that we do the right things and we do them in a financially responsible way as well.
As you think back over your career, what's been the most satisfaction? What's brought you the most satisfaction?
I would have to say, unequivocally, it's being able to touch the lives of young people. I've had the good fortune of training, at last count, about 119 residents who practice in a lot of different areas. And I learned from each of those encounters with those people, with the relationships that I developed with them. And hopefully made a difference in their lives and made some contribution to helping them get a better sense of what their strengths and weaknesses were and improving their own sense of self-knowledge, which is terribly important in building leaders. Effective leaders are people who have a high level of self-knowledge. They know who they are, what they're good at, what they're not good at. They know how to compensate for their weaknesses. And I've tried to do that not only with the well over 100 residents that I've trained, but a lot of students and other people that I've had the good pleasure of working with. I've been really blessed in terms of being put in organizations where I had a chance to make a difference. And much of that has to do with where it all started in Ann Arbor back in 1960 to 1962, in those 2 years. So that's the greatest satisfaction I have gotten is from helping people, younger people especially in our profession, who ultimately will make a difference.
A lot of young people today tell me that they recognize someone like you as an icon, as a legend, and they're intimidated to come up at a meeting and introduce themselves. What's your take on that?
Well, number one, I'm not a legend. As long as I'm not called a myth, that's okay. I'm just trying to be facetious, but on the contrary, I try to go out of my way if I'm at a meeting to initiate discussion with young people before they initiate it with me, provided it's physically possible, and I try to do that. I have never let my head get bigger than my hat size, and he was right. I try to go out of my way to be nice to young people, and I hope that they wouldn't hesitate. Now, maybe I'll be proven wrong if someone says, well, he stuck his nose up in the air when I talked to him, and I've tried not to do that. I'm just trying to be a little lighthearted here.
No, I don't think you do that at all. I often, just from my view, and I don't know how you feel, I think it's a compliment that somebody wants to meet me today.
Yeah, that's a very valid point. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Paul, for an excellent conversation. You've had a superb career, and we really appreciate you participating in this conversation.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure being with you.